Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Here's the wonderful thing about there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Here's the wonderful thing about Holden. 6 months ago, I think, when Sharon sent out the forms asking what are you going to talk about, I diligently filled them out right away and shot them back to her. And then 2 weeks ago, I thought, everything's changing. There are new things that are going on with the peace of my mind, and I sent her a note. I'm like, how late? It's too late to completely throw away everything and start over. She's like, go for it. So this is a reworked version of what we were going to do. And then even last night, as I was listening to Joe and David, and even this morning as I was listening to Glenn, I was making notes and changing it again. So I think there's kind of a beauty in that sort of spontaneity and playing off of one another. And I'm really fascinated with the different programming that's going on and how it all sort of resonates. And so as I was, who was in Glenn's morning session on Jericho? Yeah. So listening to that story of the walls coming down in Jericho, I had an image in my mind, and we don't know because of the text, but in my mind, I'm imagining that as the people inside saw other people approaching the city, that they sealed the doors, that they closed it off, and that it never happened that somebody engaged with the other. That nobody ever came out to approach the other folks and say, hey, how you doing? What's going on? What do you need? Is there something we can do together here? They just isolated themselves. And yes, that's defensiveness, that's protection, but it's also lost opportunity in how we can connect with other people around us. And so for me, that resonates really well with what we try to do with this project, A Piece of My Mind. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting, last night with Joe and David, who was in the room for that. Okay, this notion of salwa bona, which is to say, I think it's an East African word, which is to say, I see you and I hear you, and you have worth, you have value. That's something I say really often during this process. In fact, I want to share a story with you. This book that we produced, I self-published it. We did have one offer from a publisher who was a faith-based publisher, which is great because I'm a faith-based person, but they're more conservative than I am. And so they said, we'd love to publish your book if you would just remove the voices of the gay and the lesbian people. And I said, so you want me to take a project which is rooted in the notion of listening to people, no matter who they are, whether you agree with them or not, and then you want me to take the voices you disagree with and remove them? And they said, yeah. And I said, no. So we ran a crowdfunding campaign and published it ourselves so we could do it the right way. And that was a really easy choice. It was kind of a no-brainer. But the day after the book release party, I was talking to some fifth graders, and a little girl raised her hand, and she said, have you ever talked to someone who's from a family with a mom and a dad, but they're the same thing? And I had to scratch my head for a second and go, do you mean a gay or a lesbian couple? And she said, yeah. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Second story in the book, Laura Patey. Been married to her partner for 30-some years. They adopted a couple kids out of the foster care system and raised them as their own. I said, absolutely, that's a part of this collection. And she said, okay, thanks. And she paused and she said, because I have two moms. And I thought, what would it have been like if I had to say, well, sure, we've interviewed people like that, but we don't include them in the book. You know, I think that notion of salwa bona, that ability to say to somebody, I hear you and I see you and you have worth, is one of the most powerful things that we can do for one another, to acknowledge one another and to be with one another. So the project is, I'll talk more about it. Who has been in one of my sessions before? There's a few familiar folks. Okay, I'll ask for your patience a little bit as we share sort of the background of the project. because I think it really lays the foundation for what we hope we can do communally later on in the week. So maybe I'll just start with that. And I'll tell you that this is a multimedia arts project that I started 10 years ago, and it's now become my life's work. You know, this was a side little hobby thing, and it's now all that I do. It's based around this simple question: what does peace mean to you? And look, I'm out of order already. That's okay. That's familiar. Here we go. So I brought the project down to Memphis, Tennessee, not long ago, and had the chance to speak at the National Civil Rights Museum, which is in the Lorraine Motel, where Dr. King was assassinated 51 years ago now. And I was reminded of his notion of beloved community, you know, which is this notion that we could mature to see beyond prejudice and discrimination, that we could, our circles of compassion could expand to include all people. And I think you don't have to look very far to realize that we've fallen short of that mark. You know, you turn on the television, you open up the newspaper, and you realize in all sorts of ways we've failed to live up to that ideal. But for me, when things feel particularly frustrating, when it seems like the problems of today are bigger than the solutions we can bring to the table, I think it's also important to acknowledge what is right, what is good in the world. So I've worked for my entire career as a freelance photographer, and I shoot for national magazines and Fortune 500 companies. I've had the good luck to shoot travel assignments across the United States and around the world. And I've come to realize over the years that it's my job to find beauty in unexpected places. You know, the people hire me to find good where other people might struggle to see it. And that doesn't mean that we ignore the challenges of the day. You know, the world is filled with challenges, and I think it's important that we address those honestly and directly. But it's also important that we face those challenges with a grace and a hope and the belief that something better is possible. You know, as a freelance photographer, you're always making choices about the projects you'll accept. Does it square up with my worldview? Does it support ideas I believe in? And does it justify being away from my family for a certain length of time? And at our house, we've embraced the saying that you probably know, which is some jobs feed the belly, and some jobs what?
Feed the soul.
Feed the soul. Yeah, when you're really lucky, your job can do both. And back about 10 years ago, I found there were two things going on in my life. And the first is that my soul was getting hungry. You know, I was frustrated with the quality of our national dialogue. That was 10 years ago. I'm not sure we're doing better now. But so I wondered, instead of the divisive conversations that we were having in the world, I wondered if there was a way to use my photography and storytelling instead to look at what connects us, to sort of rediscover that common humanity. So that was the first thing going on. The second thing happening about the same time is, I like to say, the economy handed me some free time, if you know what I mean. The recession hit the world of freelance photography really hard, and my workload dropped quickly and dramatically. And if I was a better business person, I would have used that time to look for new clients. But like I said, my soul was getting hungry. And so this is how I decided to feed it. And I started playing around with this idea of peace that was taken right here a couple years ago. In fact, this is the one photo in the whole project I didn't take. My daughter Brenna took it with my wife Karen's cell phone. You know, this notion of peace is something that I think most people I've encountered would welcome a little bit more of in their lives, whether it's in their immediate family or the bigger world. Even my friends that serve in the U.S. military, I think, would prefer to stay home with their families when they could. But here's the thing about peace. We say we want it, but we're not very good at getting it. We're not very good at making it. And so you might have high school students who will flash the peace sign when they walk down the hall and frame up their selfies, and then they'll turn and form into cliques and bully their own classmates. You'll have a peace activist who holds a sign that says, give peace a chance, but they can't get along with their immediate family members. You know, at my church, about 1,500 miles that way, called Peace Lutheran Church, ironically. You'll have people who nod up and down on Sunday morning while they listen to the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, a story about helping somebody in need, no matter who it is, and then Monday they'll walk right by somebody in need like it's not their problem. You know, so that's not a critique of my church, that's a critique of the human condition, because it happens all the time. There's a disconnect between what we say we value and how we live our day-to-day lives. And so I started playing with this question, what does peace mean to you? And on the surface, that's a pretty simple question, but it really quickly gets at the core of who we are as human beings. What we value as a society. It opens the door to all sorts of interesting conversations about race and gender, about national policy, international priorities. And once we established the question, the process was remarkably simple. We just listened. That's it. You know, we listen in our day-to-day lives in order to debate or debunk, we'll listen to correct, coerce, or convince somebody to think the same way we do, but the act of listening just to understand, I think, can be rare. And imagine how the world could shift if we could do a little bit more of that. So when I started listening, I started hearing stories from people like Jarrell Wilson, who started his interview by saying, I'm black, gay, Christian, and I live in Texas. He said, by all means, you think I might be miserable, but in fact, I see beauty everywhere. And I heard from Penina Bowman in Atlanta, Georgia. And Penina tells a story about growing up as a young girl in World War II Europe. And she said one day, soldiers knocked on their door and they said, you've got 10 minutes to pack your things and then you got to go. And they didn't know where they were going, but they wound up going to Auschwitz. And so both of Penina's parents and 42 members of her family died at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how difficult it was to even hold on to a little bit of hope in a setting like that. But she said also that she made a choice not to hate. She said, because hate is a really powerful tool and it's intended to destroy somebody else, but in fact it circles back and it destroys you instead. Hello. Who else do we have? Oh, yeah, and Dan Gallagher out north of Missoula, Montana. And Dan's a Vietnam War vet. I used to imagine if I'd been born maybe 10 years earlier that I would have been out on the protest lines during the Vietnam War. And I always sort of admired those protesters as I was growing up. Dan helped me understand some of the damage that they did in the process. And so Dan talks about, you know, he joined the service to help his country. He went and he did his time, and when he came back from Vietnam, all he wanted to do was get back to his life. You know, go to college, maybe get married, buy a house, and keep moving forward. He said he was so derailed by the anger he was met with. You know, he was getting off the bus and a young woman was carrying a sign that called him a baby killer, and she spit on him when he got off the bus. And he said it took him years to recover from that sort of mental whiplash that he had when he got back. And Dan said, you know, we never really had the chance to talk peace with the peace people because everybody was too busy yelling at one another. So eventually this project took me on a 40,000 mile road trip across the country. Took a few years, and we did it in about 9 different trips. But meeting people from different backgrounds, asking them these questions, what does peace mean to you? How do you work towards it in your life? And the project took me places that I never knew existed. I got to go to Nicodemus, Kansas to meet Angela Bates. And Nicodemus was settled by freed slaves after the Civil War. Used to be a lot of towns like this west of the Mississippi. As far as I know, Nicodemus is the only one that still exists. You know, Angela says that she comes from a long line of people with great determination and faith in God and perseverance. And she said she was really proud of this heritage. In fact, everybody in town was proud of the heritage, so they decided to talk to the National Park Service and see if there was something they could do to honor it. And here's where we get a little tone deaf, I think, as a society. Because after about 20 years, the Park Service said, yeah, you're right, we can do that. We'll honor that place that was settled by freed slaves, and they built this beautiful museum, and they staffed it with all white people. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But there's a lot of things that don't make sense. And Angela talked about how frustrating this process was, but she also said that she realized that she had a choice about how she was going to respond to the world around her. And I think that we all have that choice. You know, we can't always control what happens to us, but we can absolutely control the way we respond to it. And so Angela got together with some other people, and they decided that they wanted to tell their own story. So they also opened up their own museum, the Nicodemus Historical Society, so that they could tell their story, because for Angela, we aren't going to know where we're headed unless we also know where we've been. There's a little whimsy in the project as well. I got to the end of the interview and I said, Angela, what do you think the chances are that we could get the whole town together for a portrait? And she said, well, I'll start making calls. She said, you'll probably get everybody except for my dad because he's kind of crabby. She said, but in fact, there he is too, right up there. So that is the whole town of Nicodemus, Kansas, 16 souls farming wheat and milo on the Kansas prairie, and one chihuahua. So I got to go places that I didn't know existed. I got to go places that that I had always heard about or always wanted to go. You all have seen the movie Forrest Gump? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the shrimp boats that have the little nets hanging? I'm a visual person, so I'm kind of driven by what I think would be interesting to photograph. So I thought it'd be really great to be able to photograph those shrimp boats. So I made a series of about 3 phone calls, which led me to Kenny Terrio, who's a third-generation Cajun shrimper down in Chauvin, Louisiana. And I asked Kenny what it was like to be a shrimper, and he said, well, you go out there and you find shrimp and then you catch them.
If they're there.
What?
If they're there.
If they're there, yes.
Which is not always
not always the case, right. Well, so I wondered to myself a little bit, I ask myself all the time, if I'm trying to talk about peace, why am I talking to a shrimp fisherman? But he went on to talk about community, and he said, you know, when we were shrimping, we all worked together. And one person would build a boat and we'd help him, and then the next one would build a boat and we'd help him, and then pretty much everybody had a boat at the end, so that worked out pretty good. So this notion to me of making sure everybody around you has the resources that you need, making sure everybody has the tools required to be able to thrive in the world, and supporting one another like that is absolutely tied into my notion and understanding of peace. So we got to the end of the interview, and Kenny said, where are you staying tonight? And I said, I have no idea, what do you suggest? Because I'm always hopeful and I'm always cheap. And he said, well, I have a burnt out RV in the backyard if you want to sleep there. I said, that sounds good. And he said, in the morning, we'll go out looking for alligators. And I said, that sounds good. And he said, if you can stay one more day, shrimping season starts and you can come out on the golf with me. And I said, that sounds real good. So we went out so I got to not only see the boats, I got to ride on the boats, and went out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and came back at 8 o'clock in the morning and found 1,200 pounds of shrimp in the meantime. And I haven't eaten shrimp since. But I never ate shrimp before, so it wasn't a great sacrifice. When I do these interviews, when I do these projects, I don't try to pretend to be someone that I'm not. So. I promise you, Kenny figured out pretty quick that I'm a bit of a tree hugger, and I promise you, Kenny is not. You know, and so we could have had some pretty difficult conversations. We could have pretty quickly shut each other down, but when you are on somebody else's boat who's taking care of you, there's a good reason to be friendly. Mm-hmm. And you know, we through the course of our conversations, we found a lot of common ground. Even if we probably voted for different people in the last election cycle, even if we approached the world in really different ways, you know, it turns out a shrimp fisherman is dependent on the weather. It turns out they may catch some one time and they won't catch some another time. Turns out a travel photographer is pretty dependent on the weather. Some days you have a job, some days you don't have a job. And so we found a lot of common ground that we could explore, even as we knew there was difference as well. So in this process, what's interesting to me is that I've done hundreds of these interviews now. I've done thousands of these shorter form stories, and people have asked me along the way what I've learned, like what's your conclusion about peace? And at first, that was a really hard question to answer, but eventually there were some themes that came up, and I want to share a few of those with you now. Oops, first I'll tell you this. Eventually I realized that there was some power in these stories, and we decided to share them sort of as broadly as we could. And so we gathered the stories into books. We gathered the stories into exhibits that we bring around the country, not to tell people the secret meaning of peace, but to invite people to be a part of the conversation, sort of to acknowledge that if there are challenges in the world, that these are our challenges to address, and if there are going to be solutions in the world, that those solutions are most likely going to come from us. And then we've also invited people to share their stories, and I'll talk about this more a little bit later, about the studio sessions that we're going to do later in the week. Hang on a second. Where the heck am I? Okay. So there are a few themes that have bubbled up, and I want to share a couple of those with you now. And these themes are specific to the individuals who shared the story, but I also think that they're universal to how we can find ways to work better together. So the first lesson is to listen to difficult realities. And as I travel, I tend to have most of these interviews, these long-form interviews, lined up before I leave home. I want to make sure that I'm productive. But the day before I got to Alabama on my southern loop, my interview fell apart. Person wasn't available, they weren't feeling well. And so I just threw it out to social media. I said, does anybody know anybody I can talk to in Alabama? Which is pretty broad net. But at that point, I just wanted to trust the process and believe that something would happen. And so two different people from different parts of my life said, well, you ought to find this woman named Joanne Bland and talk to her. And so I Googled her name, I found her number, and I called her up and explained the project. And I said, what are the chances you have 5 hours free tomorrow? And she said, come on over. So actually, first she said, let me look at your website and really understand what this is. Call me back in an hour. And when I called her back, she said, yeah, come on over. And so Joanne Bland marched with Dr. King from Selma to Montgomery when she was 11 years old. I sat in her living room with her 12 days after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. So I promise you that there were some really difficult moments in that conversation. You know, not because of anything Joanne did. You know, she was a gracious host, but because of the dynamics of what's happening in our country. Because here I am, a middle-aged white guy from up north, coming down and sitting with a civil rights icon in her living room, and she's frustrated, and she's wounded, and she's angry that we haven't yet finished the work that she started when she was 11 years old. You know, that we have not yet gotten where we need to be as a nation. And Joanne says, she said, you know, if I was a child, we might have a fist fight this morning and we'd be playing by noon. You know, we're still buddy-buddy. But adults, we hold on to our craziness. We hold on to stupidity. So you got a wall that you can throw up, and I got a wall that I can throw up that wasn't there when we were kids. You know, we just shared what children share, the sense of peace and freedom to play, to love, and to just be happy. But what happens as we grow up is life. And sometimes that makes us better, but sometimes it makes us worse. And she said, one day we'll be all right, but I'm tired of waiting for one day. I want it to be now. I want it to be in my lifetime. She said, when I was marching with Dr. King, I thought by now we'd have that beloved community he talked about, but it hasn't happened yet. You know, and I think as a nation, as individuals, we've got a lot of work to do. Yeah, and if we're going to be able to do that work, we're going to have to be willing to sit with some uncomfortable realities. I think I'll speak for myself, but maybe for others in the room too, our initial reaction becomes defensive when we have some of these conversations. We have to be able to set that defensiveness aside and sit with those stories if we're going to be able to move forward. Lesson two, look for solutions. This is John George, who I met in Detroit, Michigan. And I knew that Detroit struggled, but I'd never been there myself. And when I sat down with George, he said, you know, when the nation gets the cold, Detroit gets the flu. And he said, about now, we're suffering from double pneumonia. And John told the story of growing up next to a crack house. And he had a young child at home. He had another one on the way. And he didn't want them to grow up in that situation. So he thought about moving. He didn't want to move. He thought about, he did everything he could to change the situation. He called the police department, he called the city hall, but nobody would or could do anything about it. So John thought, okay, this is my home. You know, I pay my taxes, I take out the garbage, I mow my lawn, I don't want to go anywhere. So instead he went to the hardware store and he picked up plywood, nails, and paint. And he came back and he boarded up the crack house. And when the drug dealers came back, they couldn't get in, so they kept going. You know, so that worked out pretty good for him. And he could have stopped right there. But instead, he took that little spark and he fanned it into a flame. And he started talking to his other neighbors and said, hey, you know, maybe we can do this. And maybe we can do that. Now he runs an organization with 10,000 volunteers a year called Motor City Blight Busters. And they'll tear down abandoned buildings. They'll replace them with public gardens and public orchards, and they take what used to be a liability in the community and they flipped it to an asset. Mm-hmm. And John says that we're out to change the world and we're starting in Detroit, which I think is a pretty bold statement, mm-hmm. but I also think he might be able to do it. But he also says we all know what the problems are, and there are many, but to continue to focus on the problems and not also look for a solution mm-hmm. is our mistake. Couple more. Lesson three, stay at the table. Didn't you just say stay in the room? Yeah. So this is Maham Khan, who I met at Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. And Maham Khan is Muslim. She didn't talk much about her faith. It was a pretty private thing for her. But when she started school, she knew she wanted to get involved in an organization. She wanted to meet new people. She wanted to broaden her resume. And so she decided to join the Muslim Student Association. And she went to the first meeting, and somehow she got elected as the president. So be careful at meetings. And Maham was a little uncomfortable with that. This was a little outside of her comfort zone. But she said, you know what, I can do this. We'll study Quranic verses on Tuesday. We'll have a little pizza on Thursday. How hard could it be? What could possibly go wrong? Well, a couple weeks later, 9/11 happened. And all of a sudden, she was way outside of her comfort zone. You know, when we are that uncomfortable, we usually do one of two things. We either run away or we face it head on. And that's what Maham decided to do. So she started organizing interfaith dialogue sessions on campus. She realized really quickly that when people walked by each other in the hallways and they mumbled things under their breath, that this actually raised tension on campus. But when they sat down together and had a conversation, when they got to know one another's names, when they got to start to build a relationship, that this actually reduced tensions. And she said this worked at her campus because people were willing to stay at the table. You know, when we continue to be engaged with people, when we find conflict, and we always will, but when we're engaged, there's some hope that we can resolve that conflict, that we can find a way forward. When we walk away from the table, the hope walks away with us. And so I guess my question for you here today is, when things get difficult, will you stay at the table? Two more. Try again. This is Hassan Iksan Salim, who I think may be the only Maldivian cowboy in the world. He's the only one that I know. Maldives is an island nation off the coast of India, lowest lying nation on Earth, average elevation of 4 feet above sea level. So as climate change does what climate change is going to do, the Maldives will be one of the first places affected. Hassan had never seen a horse in his life, but he had this weird love for John Wayne movies and Louis L'Amour novels. So every year his dad would give him a toy horse for his birthday, and every year it'd get a little bit bigger. Eventually Hassan came over to the United States on an exchange program, lived with a family that lived on a ranch, and he got to see a horse, he got to learn how to ride a horse, and he got to learn how to train them in the vaquero style. Whoops. Does anybody know what the vaquero style of training is? It's a Spanish style of training. with no strict deadlines. So your horse might learn something one day and forget it the next, and then learn it again and forget it again. It's kind of like raising kids, I think. I don't know why I looked right at you, sorry. But eventually, it turns out a really, really good horse, right? And again, I ask myself, why am I talking to this Maldivian cowboy when I'm trying to talk about peace? But Hassan said, even with horses, people say, oh, you've been working with this horse for 6 months and he still sucks. His words, not mine. And I say, well, I'm going to keep on trying. And one day that horse will be great, and I'll ride him in the biggest rodeo, and I'll take him up in the high country and pull a steer, and it'll be the most beautiful thing in the world. He said, and that's the goal. He said, one day there will be peace. And maybe I'll not live to see it, and maybe my kids won't live to see it, but we'll know that we tried. We'll know that we did everything we could. And that's why we try again and again. And lesson is forgive. So, as I was bringing my exhibit out to New York University a few years back, we were driving right by Newtown, Connecticut, and the shooting had just happened at Sandy Hook. And so, as we went by the exit, there were little candles burning in the snow and flags for each of the victims, and it got really quiet in the car. And I knew I wanted to talk to somebody who was touched by public violence, right? My goal was to try to personify some of the social issues that we're dealing with as a country. So I wanted to talk to somebody who'd been touched by public violence, but I also didn't want it to be Sandy Hook because it felt too new. It felt like the families were getting beat up by being pulled out by the media for little sound bites, and the whole thing was just too recent. So when I was going through Oklahoma City, later that year, I was able to connect with Bud Welch. And Bud had one daughter, Julie Marie, who had graduated from Marquette University in Milwaukee. I'm trying to remember the year. Wait a second. Yeah, she graduated in 1995. So Julie Marie was fluent in five languages. She was offered a job with the Social Security Administration as a translator in the federal building in Oklahoma City, and 4 months later, Timothy McVeigh blew it up. And so Julie Marie and 185 other people died that day, and Bud fell apart. You know, of course he did. He became an alcoholic. He lost his businesses. He really wanted nothing more than for Timothy McVeigh to be executed. Just get him off the face of the earth and let me try to go on living my life. Until he saw a news clip of Timothy McVeigh's father on TV. And Bud said, that guy, he looks as wrecked as I am. And he realized that he wanted to meet Timothy McVeigh's dad. And it took him about 3 years to find the courage and to find the way to do that. But eventually he sat at the McVeigh family table in the kitchen with Bill McVeigh. All the family pictures hanging on the wall, including Timothy, looking down at him, and Bud said that that was the day he realized he didn't want Tim to die. And so he started working against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. He didn't succeed. You know, McVeigh was executed pretty quickly in the big picture. But now Bud goes around the world working against capital punishment, having realized that he got no sense of peace. He got no sense of relief from the loss of one more life. And Bud said, before Tim's execution, I started feeling like I was forgiving him. Now, that's a process, and it takes time. I don't know how to teach it, but I do know that I went through it. And I can tell you one thing. Forgiveness doesn't do a damn thing for the killer, but you totally free yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's where the good comes from. Does that look familiar? So, Charlottesville shooting, was that 2 years ago? I think? Yeah, I think
yes,
so.
It was 2 years.
So when we were here, you know, Holden is this great little bubble and you can leave the world behind, but of course some news leaks in, and when we were here, the white supremacists marched in Charlottesville. yeah, it wasn't the shooting, it was the car. And then somebody drove a car into the crowd for the counter protesters and killed Heather Heyer. Yeah. Also, while we were here at our hometown in Bloomington, Minnesota, somebody threw a bomb at a mosque. Same mosque where our friends Noor and Ward pray every day. And so while we were here, it felt a little difficult to know how to respond to that as we're here in the wilderness and these things are sort of raging down the mountain. And so we just decided to gather like this and hold candles and commit to take them down the mountain into a world of darkness that desperately needs it. Let me pause there for a second. Let me just add that for me, each of the stories in this project is a point of light. Each of these stories is an example of how we can live better together. Dr. King left us with a lot of good words, but one of my favorite sayings is, which you're also familiar with, I'm sure, is that hatred can't drive out hatred. Only what?
Love
can do that. And darkness can't drive out darkness. Only what?
Light
can do that. And as I work on this project, as I encounter these people, I'm more and more convinced every day that you and I are that love, and that you and I are that light, and that we've got a lot of work to do in the world. Let me pause there for a second and ask if there are questions.